Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how the future of a sales tax in Maricopa County could impact the future of growth here.
And how a local theater company envisions the future of political theater.
But first, state water officials have taken the first step in designating the Wilcox Groundwater Basin in southeastern Arizona as an active management area. That would subject the basin to the same rules related to groundwater pumping as other AMAs. There are currently six statewide, including the one in Phoenix, Prescott, and Tucson areas. Cameron Sanchez from KJZZ's Politics Desk is here to talk more about what this means and what might happen next. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning.
So what exactly does this mean? Like, what has the Department of Water Resources actually done?
Well, so far, they've just filed this notice that says they want to potentially create this AMA, which is the first step in the process. And the next step in the process is to have a public hearing, which is coming up in a few weeks. And then they're going to hear public comments there about it. So likely the community will turn out and be there in droves to say why they care about it. It seems like Hobbs has a lot of support within the community in the Wilcox Basin for this.
And so what would it mean if this area became part of an active management area? We know, for example, another area of Cochise County in the Douglas Basin, I believe, voted a couple of years ago to put themselves in an AMA. What would it mean for the Wilcox Basin?
And by the way, that vote was a huge deal because it was historic, because since the Groundwater Management Act establishing the first AMAs, no one had ever done that before. No group of Arizonans had ever voted on an AMA like that. And so Douglas is sort of paving the way. And this also would be unique if and when Wilcox goes forward with ADWR spearheading it and doing this on their own. That's never happened before either. So these are sort of uncharted waters. But basically what it means is that those areas, the groundwater basins, would be protected. There would be restrictions on how much groundwater you can pump, and there would be more monitoring of the levels of the basins.
What is the situation in that area? Like, why has this become something that, for example, Governor Hobbs has taken such an interest in?
It's bad, and it's been bad for a while. I mean, you can see reports going back years now saying that the Wilcox Basin is in danger, that it's being depleted rapidly, largely by farms. These are not really like individual people with their own little backyard wells drawing water for, you know, their own lives. This is like mega farms, giant dairies pumping rapidly with machines that, you know, a normal person wouldn't be able to acquire and use. And so essentially the water table, it just gets lower and lower and lower. And that's a concern for everybody involved who relies on that water for their lives. Plus it creates problems with the earth, like open fissures.
Right. So, Cameron, you've been on the show more than a couple of times to talk about how groundwater and AMAs are kind of a political football at the Capitol.
Yes.
What has the reaction been from lawmakers in that area and just lawmakers in general about ADWR starting this process?
Democrats happy, Republicans unhappy.
Okay.
And here's some background on that. So for the last several months, Hobbs and legislative Democrats and Republicans have been in negotiation to some degree, trying to figure out an alternative to AMAs that would be specific to rural areas like the Wilcox Basin, because AMAs are mainly in urban areas and it's sort of a different need. They want it to be tailored differently. They need some sort of rural alternative, and that's something that everyone has agreed on, but they've never been able to come together and actually finalize a plan. The devil's in the details, I guess. So this is sort of Hobbs flexing her muscles and taking her own executive action, and the Republicans are not on board with it, and they're not pleased about it.
Does it seem as though this might be something that also ultimately goes to a vote? Is this something that ADWR can impose?
It's, well, to a degree, yeah, they can impose. I mean, I think that Hobbs made it clear, though, that she still wants to work with legislative Republicans, and maybe this will be a nudge in negotiations for them to get something together a little more quickly.
Okay. Let me ask you about another water-related story from this week. We saw the state water department also send a cease and desist notice to a developer. This in closer to the valley in the Rio Verde foothills area, which, of course, you know, had their own pretty significant water problems earlier this year. What is this story all about? What's going on here?
I actually think it was our real estate department on that one, but
okay.
They're both in the executive branch. So this is once again Hobbs, if you want to look at it that way. She is the head of the executive branch. Right. And this is basically them saying to a developer, you really need to have that 100 years assured water supply to develop out here, because we have these sort of loopholes in state law that allow developers to build without an assured water supply. And that was kind of the problem in Rio Verde, is that people were building homes and living in them and not knowing that their water could and potentially get cut off and run out. And that's exactly what happened. And it was a disaster. And, you know, that situation, the crisis has been somewhat averted. But yeah, here we have the real estate department stepping in and stopping a developer who wanted to build out there and saying, no, you're potentially going to create another problem just like we had, and we're not going to let you do it.
Well, Governor Hobbs has said, and she said again this week, that she would like to close that loophole that you referenced. Does it seem as though there's any momentum at the Capitol to do that?
Yes. Yeah, totally. Everyone seems to agree, again, that it's a terrible idea to have loopholes like the Wildcat subdivisions and the build to rent, but they haven't been able to come to an agreement on it. And so maybe this will be more of an incentive for them to actually do that. And, you know, they used to say that water was not really a partisan issue,
mm-hmm.
but
yeah.
as I've mentioned on the show before, I think it's become more partisan lately. So maybe that will change. And maybe it depends on what happens in the next few weeks with this election and the breakdown of who's going to be in charge of the water committees.
All right. That is KJZZ's Cameron Sanchez from the Politics Desk. Cameron, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Among all of the initiatives and referenda on this fall's ballot is one specific to Maricopa County, Prop 479. The measure would continue a half-cent sales tax countywide for 20 years. That money would pay for transportation projects in the Metro Phoenix area. Around 40% of it would go to freeways and state highways, 37% would be allocated to public transportation, and around 22% would be set aside for arterial streets, intersection improvements, and regional transportation infrastructure. County voters initially approved the tax in 1985 for 20 years. It was then renewed in 2004 for another two decades. Over those combined 40 years, the tax is estimated to have brought in more than $13 billion for transportation projects. This year's continuation vote is supported by mayors and business groups across the valley who argue it's important to continue economic growth and development here. Critics, meanwhile, argue the tax will lead to money wasted on transit projects. Maricopa County is routinely one of the fastest-growing regions of the country, and that is driven, at least in part, by these kinds of transportation projects. So we wanted to look back and forward to get a sense of the impact of this growth and development across the valley. To do that, I'm joined by Sandy Barr, director of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, and Paula Randolph, an advocate for land use and water issues here. And Sandy, let me start with you. As we're setting our baseline here, how would you describe the evolution of the valley as it relates to growth and development over the last couple of decades?
Well, if we want to go back to 2000 approximately, that was when we were working on a growth management initiative to try to curb urban sprawl. And that is something that we have seen a lot of over the last couple of decades and before even. A lot of that has been driven by roads and freeways. And so we were trying to get some growth boundaries to really have more compact development. And the developers really opposed that at the time. They were like, oh, we hate density. Density is a bad word. And that measure went down in flames. And, you know, over the years, we have had tried to get some additional provisions without a lot of success. And then now, bringing us to today, we see that in some of those areas where they still want to do sprawl development, there is no longer physically available water for the 100-year assured water supply that is required. And, of course, there's also not adequate affordable housing. And we hear some of the developers now talking about density, and I have been the first to say, hey, I think we told you so.
Well, and it's interesting because there is more density in the valley now than even the last, you know, 10 or 20 years. A lot of valley cities have downtowns that are more up than, you know, the city's, at least the new building is more up than out in some places.
That's correct. Yeah. And you've seen a lot of it. I think in downtown Phoenix, a lot of that was driven by ASU being downtown. Mm-hmm. But and then Tempe has always been a little bit more dense. It's more on the periphery, the suburbs, that you continue to see sprawling development. And in the county areas, you see the kind of development that results in some big infrastructure issues.
Paula, when you look at the growth and development in the Valley over the last couple of decades, then I don't think anybody would argue that there hasn't been an awful lot of it. How much of that do you think is tied to the ability to have resources, for example, to build roads, to build highways, to build infrastructure that leads people to move here and continue to build here?
It certainly has an impact, I believe. We have grown tremendously in the top 10 for cities and communities in the nation. And I think it's a multitude of factors, but it is a lifestyle that people want. There are economies here or industries here that people are looking to participate in and make their living in. And let's face it, as Sandy talked about, developers saw that as an advantage and began to build in places that they felt they could make a decent profit. Some would argue more than decent, which is a fair comment. So it certainly has grown, and its transportation was certainly needed. And you see that in how the roads are built and our ongoing efforts to provide, frankly, mass transportation throughout the valley.
Where do you see the balance between growth and development and bringing jobs and bringing more people and the tax base and everything compared to sort of the environmental land use concerns, water concerns, as Sandy brought up? You know, we're in kind of a unique ecosystem here in the Sonoran Desert. So where for you is the balance of having growth and development, but maybe not too much or the right kind?
Okay, the $10 million question, if I could answer
that.
I figured
we'd just go in that pretty early on.
Yeah, we are. We're going to hit it hard. I'm going to tell you, I don't know if there is an exact answer. I mean, we watch people try and solve these really tough problems that are interconnected. And that's really what I've been thinking about, is how connected everything is. Jobs, how do we diversify our economy? How long have we talked about in the Valley, we can't live on housing alone? Mm-hmm. We have to diversify. We're starting to see that. But with that diversification, we have industries that are coming that are very water intensive. A big issue for me, clearly for Sandy as well. How do we make sure that we're capturing every drop, using it appropriately, and not forgetting about the environment? So I don't know if there's a perfect answer. I would tell you that my goal and hope is for our state is that we are thinking holistically on a variety of problems and not picking one issue, but looking at it from a comprehensive aspect, both locally from the state and, frankly, from the federal level, too, because they will impact what we do here as well.
So, Sandy, let me ask you about that, because when you look at the holistic nature of it, as Paula mentioned, there is obviously the need, if there are people living here, there's a need to have an economy and economic development and people to have jobs. But at the same time, there's a lot of concern about what it's doing to the water supply, what it's doing to the environment. So how do you look at the balance of trying to have growth and economic development while also leaving, you know, an ecosystem and environment that people can live in?
Well, I think, first of all, we don't always have to be one of the fastest growing places in the country. We continue to have that be our image. And I think we should have and should going forward think about what is truly sustainable. Yeah, we might have jobs and we might have water for today and tomorrow, but what about the next generation coming up? And is this place even going to be inhabitable? Is there going to be adequate water? And so I think we have to balance it with, you know, looking 20, 30, and yes, even 100 years out. And some things may just not be appropriate. Some things we may have to go, well, you know, instead of building another freeway, let's put more money into transit. Let's make it, you know, a more walkable, bikeable, friendly area. Unfortunately, that's something else we've seen huge opposition to at the legislature.
That is Sandy Barr. I'm also joined by Paula Randolph. More of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, is political theater a hard sell in an election year?
But first, let's return now to my conversation about the past, present, and future of growth and development in the Valley as voters weigh Prop 479, which would continue a half-cent sales tax in Maricopa County to pay for transportation projects. My guests are Sandy Barr, director of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, and Paula Randolph, an advocate for land use and water issues here. And Sandy, when you look ahead a couple of decades, let's say, based on whether or not the initiative passes, there will or will not be a pot of money coming in for things like roads and other infrastructures. So let's say you were in charge of allocating that money. How would you say it should be spent?
I would invest those dollars in maintenance of existing roads and put the bulk of it into transit. For a long time, we put almost nothing into transit and then, you know, over the last 20 years have done better, but we're still way behind for where we should be. And we don't really have a well-integrated system like we should have. And, we don't need to drive development farther and farther out into places where there isn't water. One thing, you know, we haven't mentioned about all this development and transportation is the quality of the air. And our air quality is poor. And we are about to be bumped up to Sirius for ozone. And we've known this is coming, and yet where is the action?
I think we also need to think about the ability to take our local tax dollars and have them leveraged by the federal government. So many times, federal dollars are contingent upon local dollars being invested mm-hmm. in infrastructure and so forth. If we are not willing to do that, we are going to lose out on federal dollars that I think all of us want.
Paula, I'm curious what you would do with this pot of money if you were in charge of it.
I'm going to put my personal hat on and I'm going to tell you I want public transportation. I want my own city, Scottsdale, to stop resisting mass transit. I think it's really important to have it. I think it makes us connected in a better community. We're isolated now. We all live in our own little pods. And I think that that's part of the irritation that people have with others who perhaps have a little bit different interest. And if it's easier to get around, I think mass transit lets us do that and open our eyes to how important it is to be connected, not only as our tiny city, but as you move outward. Mass transit lets you do that. I don't want to see another 8-lane highway. I'm tired of those. They don't do it for us.
Well, so what kind of transit would each of you advocate for? Because the proposal that we'll be voting on excludes the ability to use this money for light rail. So what kind of transit do you think would be best for the Valley? When you talk about having an integrated system, yes, we can use federal money or other sources of money to expand light rail or do things with light rail, but we got to do something else if we're using this proposition money.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't have written it the way it's written for sure, and you asked me how I do it. But we can invest in buses. Things that we can do relative to our roads is make them more pedestrian friendly and accommodate bikes and people walking. I mean, it's really dangerous out there. I ride my bike every morning and I'm like, okay, if you don't hear from me, check.
Oh, geez.
You know, because it really, I mean, I'm a very defensive rider, but it shouldn't be that way. We should have our roads designed to accommodate that. And I think those are some things that we can do to have a real integrated system. So I can ride my bike to the light rail and take it, you know, across the valley or walk.
Paul, go ahead.
The last mile. It's a very common phrase. It's the phrase from when you get out of your car or can get close enough to mm-hmm. mass transit to get there. That's where I'd like to see a lot of our money put toward. It gets us to so that we can use that mass transit, that bus system. We are not a very walkable city. We have a horrible walk score generally, and we need to improve that. So it's not car-centric constantly. The other thing I would tell you, too, is it would be really nice as we move out of the combustion era, I hope, that we are thinking about where people can plug in.
I want to ask both of you, when you look ahead to the next couple of decades, I'm wondering if you see now that there are leaders across the valley in whatever level of government who are thinking differently about growth and development than maybe leaders have in the past couple of decades. Like, do you get the sense that people are thinking more about infill now and will continue to do that, or think about maybe mass transit as opposed to more roads and highways going forward? Will there be a change in thinking in the valley about how we do growth and development going forward, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think there have been changes. I mean, look at Mesa. They got on board early on. They weren't, but they got on board with transit and light rail, and became not just supportive but advocates for it. And so I think we do see that. You know, when I first moved here, I lived in Mesa and then in Chandler. And one of the reasons that I moved to Phoenix was to have access to transit, because I thought it was ridiculous that it took 3 buses and 4 hours to get to where I wanted to be in Phoenix. And so I do, you know, I do see some changes in thinking. There are more, you know, they have climate plans. Phoenix has a climate plan. Mesa has a climate plan. You know, the main thing that we need to look at is getting the dollars into implementing those plans. And it's the same with transit.
Paula, what do you think? I mean, do you get the sense that leaders at different levels of government are thinking about growth and development differently now than they have in the past?
I'm an eternal optimist, Mark. So I am always looking at the hope that there are folks in the younger generations that are interested in policy and effectuating change and making the world and their community a better place. So I certainly see that.
Paula, do you think the fact that the Valley is still relatively new, as opposed to, you know, we think about places like Boston and New York and Philadelphia, which have, you know, sort of been laid out and set for a couple hundred years now, is there an opportunity in a place like Phoenix in the Valley that you maybe don't have in some of those older legacy type cities?
Absolutely. I mean, we're not baked. I think that's part of the cachet of Maricopa County and Arizona, is it gives you the ability to think more freely and to try different things. And I'm hopeful that our newly elected and folks that are actually in the legislature now will continue to listen to those voices, and young people in college, coming out of college, have some great ideas about how to solve for a lot of these issues. We see all sorts of competitions at ASU and U of A with students really coming up with very creative ideas on how we attempt to create a vibrant place.
Sure. All right. We'll have to leave it there. Paula Randolph, Sandy Barr, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
La Llorona, the Weeping Woman, is one of the most famous figures in U.S. and Mexican folklore. In the traditional version of the story, La Llorona is a woman abandoned by the man she loved and left all alone to raise their children. Overwhelmed with emotion, she is compelled to murder the children and throw them into a river. La Llorona dies alone, and in the afterlife, she is condemned to wander for eternity, looking for her drowned children, weeping and wailing. For generations, the legend of La Llorona has been passed down through oral tradition, and she's often referenced in poetry, books, and film. She even made an appearance in a 2004 milk commercial where her wailing intensifies after she opens the refrigerator and discovers an empty carton. Dr. Domino Perez has been studying La Llorona for decades. She's the author of a book called There Was a Woman, La Llorona from Folklore to Popular Culture. I spoke with Dr. Perez recently about why this story haunts our cultural imagination and how it's evolved in recent years.
Well, I think it all depends on how you interpret the story. I think historically she has been depicted as a tragic figure, but how that tragedy comes about varies. In some cases, she has been abandoned. Some cases, she has committed infanticide as an act of revenge or out of despair. The wailing is an articulation of her suffering, both her anguish and as a kind of warning, letting those who hear her know what has happened to her or the potential for something like this to happen to really any woman.
Yeah. You know, I hadn't considered this until we started talking, but here in the U.S., this election cycle, obviously the agency and personhood of women as distinct from whether or not they have decided to have children is a subject of great and very intense discussion. And it struck me in terms of what you were just saying that you could also interpret La Llorona's decision to kill her children to get back at her husband as a way of her saying, like, I am not defined by the fact that I am a mother to these children. I am maybe even first and foremost a person who you betrayed.
Absolutely. One of my favorites, it's a poetic triptych by Cordelia Candelaria. And she looks at in these three poems, she looks at La Llorona in different stages of her life. There's one poem that focuses on her before the weeping and the wailing began. So she's a young girl before any sort of tragedy has happened. Mm. And then in another one, she has become the kind of boogie woman who lurks along the shores of rivers or sometimes, you know, outside ill-behaving children's bedrooms. And then the third portrait is of her as an older woman. It's a quiet poem about, you know, La Llorona washing her feet before she has to start wailing and wandering again. And as she's washing her feet in the river, she sees her children reaching out for her and her agony begins all over again. And I think that's a powerful portrait of womanhood that says this figure doesn't exist in isolation. Something happened to this woman. She was once a young girl who was filled with all of this innocence and all of this potential, and something or someone failed her.
Yeah. Boy, I got chills in your unfolding of that description of the triptych. It's so empathic and powerful, as you say, to consider a version of this story where the crime, like all crimes, doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Absolutely. The importance about La Llorona's story is that it's incredibly adaptive. What we would call in folklore, it's dynamic. It's always changing. And it remains relevant because her people and the people who are telling stories about her find her relevant. So, for example, during the previous administration, we saw an uptick of La Llorona stories around the border. And when you think about the child separation policies and the images that we saw of, you know, children in cages and children being taken away from their parents, the person or the entity that's taking away La Llorona's children is not La Llorona, or it's not even the man, it's the state.
I'm curious for you, how did you first discover the story and what was compelling to you about it?
So our family used to gather. We were a very extended family, used to gather. Any sort of big holiday, we would all get together. And there was a lot of food preparation that was taking place, and it was gender segregated. And the men would be outside minding the barbecue, and the women would be inside. And I wanted to be where my male cousins were, and they were outside. And so I remember sneaking out one night, and they were exchanging stories about this terrifying woman. One had seen her. He was driving home one night in the back roads of Texas, and he kept passing this woman, this hitchhiker, on the side of the road. And then the last time he encountered her, she was standing in the middle of the road, and he slammed on his brakes so the truck didn't hit her. And then she turned into a flock of birds. I was terrified. Yeah. I was terrified,
and I went
running away from that storytelling circle. And you know, I was convinced that this woman, this La Llorona, was a figure that specifically haunted the men in my family. And then strangely, it was when I was in graduate school and we were reading Rudolfo Anaya's Bless Me Ultima, the young protagonist is warned about La Llorona. And I thought, wait a minute, how is this even possible? I haven't even heard of La Llorona since I was a kid. Hmm. And that just was the beginning of me going down the rabbit hole. And so I feel like, I don't think I found La Llorona. I think La Llorona found me.
Hmm.
And I've been a steward of her story now. I don't think she's ever going to quite be done with me.
Yeah. Well, it seems like she has a lot of unfinished business from the way
she does.
We've been talking about her. As a last question, I'm curious to know, in all these years of being a steward of her story, as you put it, do you ever feel like you've had a direct encounter with her?
So people always ask me this question. They some version of this question. They say, you know, do you think La Llorona is a story? Do you think she's real? Do you think she's a spirit? Do you think that she's this kind of avenging angel? And my answer is always yes. I guess the way to describe it would be that she's always in the periphery. Like, I can see her in the periphery, but I can't turn my head quite slowly enough to get a full glimpse of her. But I know she's there. You can't ever be a temporary steward. Once she picks you, you're picked for life.
Well, Dr. Domino Perez is a professor in the Department of English and at the Center for Mexican American Studies at UT Austin. Dr. Perez, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. It is less than 2 weeks until Election Day, and voters are tired, especially in swing states like ours. We're getting inundated with ads and emails and campaign messaging. The amount of money being spent on political advertising will likely vault past $10 billion this year, and most of it is negative. So much so that our next guest says all of this advertising may be hurting candidates more than helping them, not to mention what it's doing to the rest of us. Heather Lamar is an associate professor of media and communication at Temple University in our fellow swing state of Pennsylvania. Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
I guess I want to start with a little bit of like condolences, maybe like a high five, right? Like you're in another swing state as well. And you know what this is like, just like I do here in Arizona. Let's talk a little bit about what this has been like in the last several weeks, months in Pennsylvania in terms of just the election overload in that swing state.
Well, I think everybody is turned off and tuned out. Anyone I talk to, whether it's neighbors, friends, students, colleagues, research partners, it's really so exhausting to the point that people can't take it anymore. So they've just starting to completely tune out.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I want to talk about the advertisement side of that, because, I mean, it's on the news. We're talking about it all the time as a journalist. I can't escape it in that sense, right? But it's also advertisements everywhere on TV, on social media. My phone is being flooded with text messages, right? Like, it also seems like all of these ads are negative. Talk a little bit about how we got here and why these political ads are so pervasive today.
So to be fair, they've been negative basically since the start. So when we first started doing television ads in the 1960s, they were negative. And the most famous example of that is the Daisy ad. Mm-hmm. That was Lyndon B. Johnson, Barry Goldwater.
8, 9, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Are the stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live.
And that was such a shocking and alarming ad that research now, what we know now about behavioral science is that it was so shocking and alarming that that was probably what made people tune into that ad. But at the time, it was seen as, oh, negative ads work. Let's run with that. And they ran with it. I mean, they really ran with it. We saw just even in this current election, the Wesleyan Media Project is tracking negativity at over 95% of advertising. But we've always trended negative. Harris' campaign has been a little bit more positive than Trump, but some would argue that's because she has to introduce herself to the country.
Truth, justice, decency, equality, freedom, democracy. These aren't just words. They're the values we as Americans cherish. And they're mm-hmm. all.
So a little bit of her advertising has been policy oriented. But overall, we're sitting around 90, 95% negativity in this election.
A second term would be worse. There will be no one to stop his worst instincts. Unchecked power, no guardrails. If we elect Trump again, we're in terrible danger.
How did that happen? Like, was there a time, you said negativity has always been a part of political advertising, but just the pervasiveness of it, has that been true always, or did anything change to make that happen?
I think a couple things have changed. There was some early research in advertising in general and in journalism, political journalism, that showed us that people pay closer attention to negative information. I'm probably even a little bit guilty of this in my own research. I did a whole stint of research in the early 2000s, mid-2000s on political satire, where we sort of reaffirmed that notion that satire, which is inherently negative and critical, garners more attention than regular news. So political strategists have picked this research up and sort of come to the conclusion that more negativity is better. Mm. And that's a false conclusion for them to come to. We actually have meta-analysis that show the opposite, but we can see how they got there.
Yeah. Citizens United changed this landscape as well, right?
What Citizens United did is it opened the floodgates to money. And we moved from having less than about $1 billion totally spent in election to this year, they're forecasting upwards of 10.8 billion, 10.9. I've even seen estimates as high as 15 billion. I'm not sure we'll go that high. But nonetheless, to go from less than a billion to 10, 11 billion from the year 2010 till now shows you this trajectory upwards. And what's happening is because you have that much money flooding the system, and it's everywhere because of micro-targeting. It's everywhere from your text messaging and your email to your streaming to your television shows. Mm-hmm. And that amount of money is causing this chronic exposure to advertising. But since most of the advertising is negative, then it is having this really bad boomerang effect of chronic exposure to negative information 24/7, and you can't get away from it. And it is just creating an intense level of anxiety and stress and across the entire electorate.
Right. So there is real kind of exhaustion from this, what it does to us all psychologically. Does it work, though? Does negative advertising have the kind of results that campaigns hope it does?
Well, no, actually, no. The short answer there is absolutely not. In fact, the science says the opposite. We have a couple really big meta-analyses that have been done in the field by different scholars that have taken all the small different studies, hundreds of studies, collectively looked at them to look at the total overall effects. And it's a net neutral at best. So the best case scenario is it doesn't really move the vote at all. But in a lot of cases, it's a net negative, meaning voters get so frustrated, angry, they feel like its privacy is being invaded, they feel exhausted, stressed out, fatigued, that it's causing a boomerang effect where people are either just not going to turn out to vote or intentionally vote against the person who they feel is violating their privacy and their texting.
Interesting. I want to ask you one more question about micro-targeting, which you mentioned, this kind of new frontier of advertising in this realm. How specific can they get? How much of my personal information, right, like are campaigns able to use to target me?
So the campaigns are just like any kind of other brand. They can buy information from data farmers. Mm-hmm. And that can be touch point down to where exactly you are in your car at what time of day on a 9-to-5 drive. They know where you shop. They know what your grocery list is. They know everything about you. And they use this information to create what we call a psychometric profile. This goes well beyond your party ID and well beyond your vote behavior.
So obviously a negative and a psychological kind of impact on all of us, especially those of us here in swing states, right? I guess my last question is, how are we going to get through the next couple of weeks? And is there any end in sight? Like, does this kind of advertising just stop when the election ends? Does it change?
Well, I think that it's going to change. We're going to have election results, and then what will shift is the focus. The focus of the advertising will become more on policy debates. What I would say as far as how we get through it, if there's a silver lining in what's happening, is that it's strangely bringing people back together against sort of this common enemy. Like, we live in this very polarized, divided nation, and people are tired of that. And whether you're on the left or you're on the right, you're equally fatigued by this, and you're equally sort of depressed and anxious about the amount of stress this is putting on everybody, their family, their friends, their work relationships. And so I think if there is a silver lining to be had, it's that people can kind of come together and have a sigh of relief when it's over. And we can all sort of look at each other and say, yeah, I know, I'm tired of it too. And we can move sort of on to things that matter more to us, like going to see our children, you know, play in a sports event, yeah, or celebrate Thanksgiving with family and friends.
Let's hope it's over by then. All right. Heather Lamar.
Please don't say that.
Heather Lamar joining us, Associate Professor of Media and Communication at Temple University in Pennsylvania. Heather, good luck to you in another swing state. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Yes, likewise. Good luck to you guys down there in the Sunshine States.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. A while back on the show, we spoke to Heidi Schreck and Kate Haas, the creator and star, respectively, of Phoenix Theater's production of What the Constitution Means to Me. The show tracks a young constitutional scholar's realization that the framers of the Constitution had almost no understanding of women's lives. It was a smash hit when it premiered on Broadway back in 2019. But that was several political lifetimes ago, and the production at Phoenix Theater was cut short due to low ticket sales. And that got us wondering if there's still an audience for political theater. So I reached out to Phoenix Theater Artistic Director Michael Bernard for a debrief on what went wrong and why.
Somebody will read the title, oh, What the Constitution Means to Me. Hmm. Oh, I wonder what, is this a political show? Is, you know, what, and I don't want to go and hear about the Constitution being bad or slammed or whatever.
Right.
And even though we tried to explain.
Yeah.
What exactly the show was, it didn't seem to resonate.
Yeah.
And now, we were scheduling it for a long, I mean, a really long run, like 14 weeks, 15
right.
weeks. Could we have continued on? Yes. Or could we try to put something in there that might, I don't know, perk up the mm-hmm. end of those last 4 weeks? And so we just sort of did something that was fun and fluffy and et cetera, and it did okay.
Uh-huh.
But
which was?
Oh, it was a tribute artist. She did covers for like Dolly Parton,
uh-huh.
Okay. Reba McEntire, mm-hmm. and things like that. So it was kind of, and she was delightful,
mm-hmm.
The audiences loved it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking about this. I know it's difficult to talk about.
Hmm.
And for me, it puts its finger on something that I'd love to get your take on,
sure.
which I think is one of the oldest questions in theater, which is, who is this for?
Well, first and foremost, theater was originally created to discuss and bring forth ideas or subjects that the society at that time was going through.
Mm-hmm.
So I would much rather be a part of something that is responding to a social conversation, a social challenge, something that we can offer
mm-hmm.
that creates a dialogue. We just did cabaret. Well, what was happening in 1929
yeah.
in Germany?
Mm-hmm.
There are similar things that are happening in our world today. So, but you put it in a different era or a different place, and you can reflect on it in a from a different perspective.
Right.
And heaven knows, get a young person out of the phone.
But that phone thing is interesting to me because I love the way you framed it, that from its very beginnings, theater was a forum for members of a community to speak to other members of a community about hot button subjects. And our phones now are by and large where we go for that. You know, yeah. we get so much of that same impact from something like TikTok or Instagram Reels or something where people are, in many cases, doing little mini pieces of theater, you know, performance art. And so it raises this question about what can theater do that the phone can't do?
I don't think about that per se, but I do think definitely about how do we engage a younger audience? So now the point is to do things that have subject matters to them that they're interested in. And I think they're very interested in learning about acceptance and hope and what can our future be and what could our future be and what has held us back and what happened before that we could do differently now.
It makes me think about Cabaret, which you were just mentioning and which you guys ran recently. And you were talking about the political context of that story. If I'm not mistaken, Cabaret premiered in the 50s? 64. Okay. So at that point, you're not so many years removed from Weimar Germany.
Like 20.
Yeah. and the resonance of that is completely different than doing it now when it also has this patina of being a Broadway classic and, you know, the lead role having been turned into kind of a crucible for great actors and all these sorts of things. How much do you think about with something like that preserving the original political context?
I think Cabaret is an anomaly.
Mm.
I've never really known of another show that has the name value to it as strong as Cabaret, and yet it has been reinterpreted probably differently than any other revival musical I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
The original musical in 1964, the audiences and what they would accept and not accept is quite different than what the audience will accept and expect to accept today.
Mm-hmm.
And so the new interpretations are much edgier. In the early 60s, they could make or nod to the idea the Kit Kat girls are do other professions besides dancing things of that nature. But it was all done very big, happy.
Right. It's there if you know to be looking for it.
Yes.
But, yeah.
But it's pretty masqueraded. And I chose to do it where the masquerade was there at the beginning, and then slowly it was shredded and taken away.
Oh, that's interesting.
Much the same way as the Nazi Party, when they were first trying to get a foothold in Germany, they would do anything and everything for anybody. And you could, we'll provide you this and we'll do that and it's going to be great. And just listen to us. Believe in us. We'll take care. We're going to make Germany perfect, you know, and you're not going to have to worry about a thing. Just follow us and everything will be great. And slowly but surely, that was where that went. And then as they took a stronger foothold, that mask kind of went away, and then you began to understand what had happened, and you've bought into it, and now it's too late.
Yeah. So this is fascinating to me because, you know, I feel like your answer has disproven the idea behind my question, which is you're saying that your approach with Cabaret has been to move closer to the original political context and intention of the production, not farther away, not to treat it like a museum piece, not to treat it like something that lives behind theatrical classic glass, but rather to get closer to the really raw...
what the original text was.
Yeah.
Mm. That, and to me, Cabaret is more relevant today than I think it's been in...
Absolutely.
...since it opened.
Yeah.
So
what did you find in terms of audience reaction? Did people connect with...
Yes, I really, truly do believe that. We didn't get a lot of pushback from taking a political point of view. We weren't taking a political point of view. We were literally saying, this is what happened in Germany in 1929.
So as you think about going forward, do you think the experience with Constitution will change the way that you think about season planning?
No. I think, if anything, we may decide that yes, we're going to do this piece, but we'll probably only run it 3 or 4 weeks because we just don't have a large enough audience that's interested in that niche piece. Mm-hmm. But that, I don't think we should not do something based on that. I just choose a piece that says, here's what happened. You choose how you feel about this.
Well, Michael Bernard is the producing artistic director at Phoenix Theater Company. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. Thank you.
And that'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.